What's up, founders, and welcome to the In Demand podcast, where we talk all about how to troubleshoot growth for your PLG SaaS. I'm your co-host, Asia Arangio, the CEO and founder of Demand Maven.
And I'm Kim Talarczyk, client services manager at Demand Maven, where we help SaaS companies reach their toughest growth milestones.
All right, Kim, let's get into it. All right. Welcome to the In Demand podcast. I am your host, Asia Arangio, CEO and founder of Demand Maven, and I am joined by my lovely co-host, Kim Talarczyk. And we have a fun topic for you today. And Kim, I'll let you kick off. But yeah, this is about something that I have observed, worked with over the last 8 years now of running Demand Maven. And I think that there's a way to avoid some of these pitfalls and make this more successful. But yeah, Kim, I'll let you take it away. Kick us off.
Yeah. So our topic for today is when companies, non-SaaS companies, want to create their own, either like a spinoff or within their company, their own little SaaS business. So what are some of these businesses that you've heard from? Agencies, right, Asia?
Yeah. So I would say like every year I have around 10 to 15 calls with companies that are like this, where it's usually a non-SaaS company, again, that has decided to create like a SaaS product, and now they want to spin it off and sell it independently of the non-SaaS business. This can be anything from agencies, like I've seen marketing agencies, PR agencies, various like consulting firms in a number of different industries, everything from like project management consulting firms to manufacturing consulting firms to I feel like I've seen almost every type of business. What I find to be a very interesting commonality or pattern here is it tends to be services is definitely a very common trend. Like this is usually like a large scale services business of some kind, or like it certainly could be like more like an agency where they're focused on execution, but usually it's some type of strategic consulting service in some kind of way. And also it's usually in an industry where technology is not necessarily like the most common, or it's not like at the helm of innovation for that particular industry, such as things like imagine like construction or even like commercial real estate. Are there tech companies in those industries? Yes. But it's not necessarily like those industries are not led or guided by tech in the same way that you see marketing or sales or other software companies, et cetera. So I'm usually like there's a pattern here regarding like those types of companies. And that's not to say that that's like a success or failure indicator. I'm just noticing like that seems to be like the common pattern.
Yeah. Okay. And so why does this happen? What is triggering these companies to say, okay, now it's time to get into SaaS?
Yeah. Great question. I think there are a couple of things. The first is usually what ends up happening is especially if they're a consulting firm or like a services firm, usually what ends up happening is in order to deliver their service, they end up needing to build software of some kind. And even when I was working at the technology consulting firm that I worked at in Atlanta a bajillion years ago now, we actually had examples of this. Like we had our own like time tracking software that we built internally. There were other like little like micro tools that we had built that we would use for client projects. And we would use it to facilitate or deliver, speed up the process in some kind of way. Because obviously, like from a consulting services perspective, you're incentivized to reduce the amount of investment, like reduce the amount of overhead it takes to deliver a service. So return. Yeah, exactly. Time is quite literally money in an agency or services firm or consulting firm. We were incentivized to build tools that would help our delivery team deliver everything faster, more effective, cheaper, et cetera, while still maintaining quality. And I think a lot of services businesses out there, especially if they're large and they have maybe like larger scale size deals, like maybe their average contract is upwards of like 250 to 500K, maybe even a million or 2 million. They are absolutely incentivized to build systems and tools and processes that help them deliver their work faster, cheaper, et cetera. And I think a lot of businesses kind of end up in that scenario where they're like, they're delivering these 500K, $1 to $2 million projects. And part of that offering ends up being the software. And sometimes these like firms will take it a step further and they'll say, let's actually productize this and give it a name And they might not even have intentions of selling it publicly, like outside of a consulting project. They still might like productize it in some kind of way. And I think that that sometimes that can go even further. And then they start getting the idea of like, oh, like, well, we've productized this. What if we started to spin this off into its own brand and its own business unit? And now let's sell this publicly, like outside of our consulting deals or outside of our services agreements or what have you. So it used to maybe be an add-on or a part of like a service agreement in the consulting context, but now let's actually try to go to market with it like outside of that as its own product. So that's, I think, the first way that this gets triggered and how this like actually starts and how it happens. The other way that I think that this kind of starts is I see this in services firms that have many different types of service offerings and possibly even for many different types of industries. But we see this also with companies that want to diversify their revenue streams. And I think you hear, I know for a fact that in the services world, because, and I say this from experience, because we would hear the same whisperings and almost like we were haunted by the fact that, you know, with a services company, you can only grow X percentage or whatever, whatever. It's very margins based. You should have like software is so much better because it's not dependent on overhead and like the people that you have on your team. It's dependent on the software. Like growth feels infinitely more scalable. And so I remember like back in the day when I was in my, when I worked at the consulting firm that I worked for, I'll never forget, like we would always, it was like a siren song. It was like, oh, software, like grass is always greener on the other side, right? So like, oh, software, like you guys should like build and sell software because that's way better, easier, cheaper, faster than whatever the hell it is that you're doing now. And
right.
I think some consulting firms hear the siren song of software and they start imagining a little bit of magical thinking and a little bit of wishful thinking of like, oh, this is going to be so much easier and better and blah, 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 blah than what we're doing. So we should diversify our revenue streams and build something and sell it outside of our consulting services or whatever it is.
It's like, if only we could just see X dollars a year come in through this easy to make product that people will pay monthly for.
Yes. And there's always like a little bit of like, Delulu wishful thinking around this of like, I remember like what it felt like. We would always get so like glossy eyed when we would think about software of like, oh, that would just be so much easier. But I think this is one of those cognitive distortions where it's like the less you understand something, the more that you think it's going to be easy or simple or whatever it is. And then the more that you learn about it, the more that you realize like, oh my gosh, it's the Dunning-Kruger effect essentially. But I think it's also a little bit of like, just grass is greener on the other side. Like it's this, like you're so used to your business economics and your context, which in services and consulting is pretty like fixed, like it's adhered to how like how your team is actually structured and how efficient you can ultimately deliver services and the return of revenue of delivering a service. And I think like you just get like that siren song of software just feels so attractive, even though it is quite possibly one of the hardest businesses to build, to master, to grow. But if you're only coming at it from a consulting and services perspective, then you're not going to know how hard it is really until like you actually do it. So I think that's right. How it all starts. And
yeah,
there are certainly other scenarios. And I think, you know, we've actually seen very large organizations that aren't like services based think about software and still want to like attempt to kind of build out something of their own. But it's a similar, I think, scenario. And I think it also builds over several years is what I find too. A lot of these companies have been around for 10 to 15 years, and they're kind of looking for like the next revenue stream and the next business opportunity. And I think this is also what kind of gets people thinking about, oh, we should do tech or we should do software or we should do SaaS.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's not necessarily just an impromptu thought a year into a business, which also maybe what makes it seem like, oh, maybe this actually is a good idea. So Let's talk more about why SaaS is so hard then.
Yeah. Why does this not pan out the way that people think it will?
Right.
There are so many reasons. And I feel like I do kind of wish I had been recording like all of my calls over all these years, because we could compile a master list, I'm sure, of what are all the ways that this totally falls apart. And I have had the honor of working on a few that were in this scenario. And this is also part of where I'm coming from as well. Like, I'm not saying this as someone who hasn't worked in this exact scenario. I've lived it not only in my previous lifetime of working in-house as like head of marketing for some of these like technology consulting firms, but I've also worked with clients that are under like certain constraints where they're hoping to spin off a SaaS company, but the parent company that they're in is not a SaaS company. And that actually makes it even more challenging, in my opinion. It's already difficult and challenging to run a SaaS business as it is. Doing it within the context of a non-SaaS company, I think actually makes it even harder because you're beholden to the context of that business. So if you are used to a services business and you're used to thinking about your business economics and your unit economics in terms of consulting, then when you look at SaaS and how to build a SaaS or a software company, you are operating under completely different metrics. The way that you need to think about growth is also completely different. And also the expectations that you have for how quickly you'll be able to build and to sell and to invest are also very different. And I think what a lot of these organizations kind of forget about is you are literally building an entirely different company. And I want you to imagine how, like, when you think about the first 2 to 5 years of your organization, what did those first 2 years look like? How messy was it? How unpredictable was it? And I think a lot of people forget that when you start a new business or a different brand, in some ways, I think if you have a really strong parent company, like a really strong parent brand, then translating this into SaaS, like your mileage may vary on this. But what I find 9 times out of 10 is when you're spinning off a new product, a new brand experience of some kind, and it's not just like your company, like your consulting firm, you are under the same challenges, pressures, context as any other SaaS business. And it's hard and it takes forever. It takes way longer than what you think it's going to take to build, to operationalize, to grow. I do think, and obviously like your mileage may vary. Like it depends on like how much are you charging for this product. But there are other things too that kind of go into play with go-to-market. But I'll pause here. Go ahead, Kim.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that's interesting insight because what you're saying is like you're kind of starting from scratch in a lot of ways. But I think the misconception might be, well, we already are doing successful things in our business. We can build off of that, but not necessarily true just because the nature of SaaS and it's a completely different model. And so that's really interesting. And I think a good point for people to think about.
The most successful, just to give context here, the most successful example that I've seen of this actually was a dev consulting firm that decided to build like dev tools. And of course, like they would sell it through like their consulting practice. But what made it successful was when they spun off these tools, they still kept it as part of the main brand. And they were in a very unique position because development tools and development services do like logically go hand in hand. Like you're already in the technology space and it's not a stretch for someone to expect you to build software and then sell it to them. Maybe in the same way that like if you were in commercial real estate or in construction or in manufacturing or in energy, you're selling services to operationalize something for them or improve something for them. It might feel like more of a stretch for you to sell tech to them because it's not an expectation necessarily from like that industry perspective. But this is, of course, there are going to be exceptions to the rule here, but this was actually the one example that I was like, oh, this was actually successful. But I think it was successful because of the context, of the market context. This was already in technology and it was already in like developer land. The development consulting firm spun off these tools and they made it clearly like a connection between those two brands. So it didn't feel like those tools were starting off from scratch in the same way that like it's going to feel like you're starting from scratch. Like if you are in construction and you're spinning off a technology company, that's all of the like brand equity that you've built on the top end isn't necessarily going to translate immediately into that new SaaS that you're building, even though it seems like it will. And I think that there are some cases where, of course, there are exceptions to the rule. But I think a lot of brands overestimate how much of that brand equity will translate to this entirely new brand. And purely because, and this is my other point, going into go-to-market, the reason why a lot of like these internal SaaS products do get sold is because of the brand equity through the consulting context or the services context. You're already selling to these accounts services. Lumping in software is an easy sell because you've already got the brand equity and you've already built the rapport and you've already created confidence within that account. But when you spin off a SaaS company and now you're trying to get net new customers, that brand equity doesn't translate the same way. Because if you're attracting people who wouldn't consider your consulting services anyway, which nine times out of 10, that's what they want to do. They want to attract people who aren't like clients necessarily or consulting clients. They want to attract these like net new in the market people who need to solve their problem with software. But the brand equity doesn't translate. And so you really are starting from scratch. And I think a lot of these like parent brands, they underestimate the impact of that and they overestimate their brand equity translating to that new product. And I think that is usually like a shock for them. And then what I find 9 times out of 10 happens, sometimes, you know, like I said, your mileage may vary, you might get lucky. But what I end up finding happens instead is they're surprised that their SaaS is not flying off the shelf. And they're like, oh my gosh, this is hard. And it's like, yes, you are starting a whole new brand. You're starting a whole new business. And I think you have to weigh the trade-offs. And I question, and I'm not saying that brands shouldn't, like if you're a parent brand and you're thinking about spinning off a SaaS, I'm not saying that you shouldn't do this. But what I am saying is you got to think about the strategic trade-off here. Because in order to make that brand successful, it means you're going to have to make investments that are going to be uncomfortable. They're not going to pay off probably for several years. And it's always more of an investment than what you think it will be because that brand equity doesn't just translate perfectly and amazingly and seamlessly. So you have to weigh the trade-off of, is it worth me building out this whole SaaS company, this whole own brand and product? Is that more worth it than just continuing to sell it internally through our consulting practice? And I think that's the strategic question that I don't see enough of these companies asking themselves and then actually doing like the cost benefit analysis of. So like, let's actually measure what's it going to cost us to invest to make this thing grow. Now, similarly, what's the return of that? And is that actually better than us continuing to use this software as a competitive differentiator in our consulting practice? Like there are so many other ways to position that internal SaaS that doesn't require you to go to market to strangers, essentially, who don't know you from Adam under a completely different brand name, et cetera. So I think that's part of it. But there are certainly other ways that this totally falls apart. But I think those are the first 2 to 3 that come to mind.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And so you talked about a success story partially with that dev tool. So people that actually want to now go into this, say, let's explore what it looks like to kind of do a SaaS spinoff. How are they avoiding failure now?
Yeah. So I think that there are a couple of ways. And I actually have a list here because I was like, okay, what are all of the pitfalls that I see and how do you overcome them? I think the first is you need a dedicated resource. And what I mean by that is, this kind of goes back to one of the pitfalls. So the other reason why I see this fail very consistently in like parent brands, we'll call them, is because they're hoping that they can outsource everything. And there is no real internal full-time owner, not even part-time, but full-time owner of this SaaS product. That person needs to be kind of like a president or a principal or like a GM, a general manager. Yep. Like this person kind of, it's like the internal CEO basically. And they need to really be the CEO of that SaaS product. And they need to have a budget. And they need to ideally be full-time. Ideally, this is not someone who's part-time on it. I've seen teams trying to kind of cobble together almost like a committee, so to speak. But because no one's full time, it means that no one really gives it their full focus, which also means it doesn't really go anywhere. The reason why bootstrapped companies and funded companies perform well is usually because there is a dedicated founder. Even if they're not full time on it, they're dedicated. They are actively, and they're kind of like everything. They're the developer, they're the business manager, they're literally everything. And in funded scenarios, usually the core founding team are full-time on the product by that point. Not always, obviously, like there's certainly exceptions to the rule. And there are certainly bootstrap founders out there who are not full-time on their own products, but who are able to make it grow because they're not under any type of like time pressure or anything to make it work. They're not forced to make it work. They're able to spend their time, you know, taking as long as I want, and rightfully so. When you're bootstrapped, you can literally do whatever you want, which is kind of the beauty of being bootstrapped. But when you're thinking about this as like its own separate business unit that needs to be profitable eventually, like it needs to produce some return, otherwise it doesn't make sense to necessarily do unless it's just part of like your mission or your vision. But it has to have a dedicated resource that it ultimately is like the GM or the principal, the president, et cetera. And the reason why is because someone has to actually own the decision-making. Someone has to own the budgeting. Someone has to own and be responsible for basically being the founding member of this new brand. It's kind of like I said, starting a whole new business. It's really tough to start a new business with like 2 to 5 part-time people. And when I think about, like, there are certainly scenarios where that exists, but when I think about those types of businesses, it takes them 5 years, four to five years even, like to really be able to afford to bring everyone full time. Like I've seen this time and time again. And I'm not saying that's wrong, but I'm just saying that that type of expectation setting that you have to be thinking about is if you can't afford to put full time resources on this, you're playing a time game at that point. So it's about longevity now. It's about, you know, how long can you wait and then continue to invest before like it doesn't make sense anymore? And that's why I say you either fully commit or you don't, but the trade-off is obviously time. If it's a bunch of part-time resources on the product, it's going to take you longer. It just will. It's kind of the iron triangle, so to speak, scope, time, and budget. If you don't have the budget or you're not clear on the scope, it probably will take you much longer. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think it's just, we just have to honor and acknowledge it. And I think that maybe that's what a lot of these brands don't understand at first, or maybe they're not thinking about it in that way. Because again, they get the siren song in their head a little bit of, oh, it's software, so it'll be easier and faster. But actually, maybe that's true after you've reached certain economies of scale and you're profitable. But to get there is actually long and hard and expensive, and especially if you're starting from scratch. And I think that's what a lot of brands underestimate. There are a few others, yeah, so though, but that's the first one for sure.
Investing a little bit more upfront in like that full-time GM probably makes sense. If you're investing money anyways over the long term, so if you're going to give it a shot, it makes sense to kind of bring that full-time resource. Now, does that GM person have to be technical?
So this is where I don't think they do have to be technical, but I do think it depends on the other thing, which I was going to mention, is budget. How much is the brand willing to invest in this, and for how long before they see a profitable business unit? On average, what we see is 2 to 3 years before it's profitable. There are some, but like I said, your mileage may vary. There are some products, like if you're charging, you know, $50,000 per license or installation or whatever, like if your pricing is such that you're charging quite a pretty penny, like maybe you're selling to enterprise like right off the bat, then you'll probably see profitability very quickly, in theory at least. When it comes to development costs, however, typically what I see is this depends on like, did the parent brand already have the product internally and now they're just kind of like sequestering it off into its own thing? Or are they like, we're starting from scratch, like quite literally, let's build something. You will invest anywhere from $200,000 to $800,000 just in development and product management costs. And that's assuming that you're starting from scratch. If you actually have already built the product internally, you've probably already spent that much and it's now a sunk cost. But now there's a cost to provisioning it into its own product, and that has its own. And that's a variable. It could be, I guess I'd be shocked if it were more than $500,000, but that could be anywhere from like $100,000 to $300,000, but it just depends. So that's like initial investment. And then with every product company, there is a head of product, and then there is head of development, or someone who's ultimately responsible for developing the product. A lot of brands will outsource this. And ideally, like whoever your GM is kind of like your head of product as well. They don't have to be technical, but they do need to understand how product works, what product management looks like. It is very different than delivery management and operations management. They're very different. Value is ultimately derived from the features that you build or develop or determine. And value is experienced through product, but with delivery, it's experienced through people and services. And you can coach and train people. You can create new processes. You can analyze data differently. Like, there are so many different things that you can do to impact how you think about service and value delivery when it's through services. But when it's through product, it's a different headspace. And you certainly can outsource this part of the job. But I will say, I do think it's something that a lot of parent brands also underestimate in the beginning of needing. Because again, and this is contextual, if you're a parent brand spinning off a SaaS and you're hoping to sell it to strangers who aren't coming through, like, they're not getting exposure to your product through consulting anymore or services anymore, they're total strangers, you are going to need to contend with your product roadmap, how it actually services that part of the market, again, who don't know you from Adam and who aren't coming to you through your consulting practice. And I think a lot of parent brands underestimate the need for that. And they're kind of thinking like, oh, well, we built it. Now let's just go sell it as is. But the reality is the market's going to have a lot of other expectations on for your product that you might not have considered or thought about and or want to build. And so now we're playing a number of different games. Again, how much do we want to invest in this? How seriously are we going to take it? And for how long are we going to invest in this before we see like any reasonable amount of return? Obviously, this is dependent on who you're selling to, how much the product is worth, or like how much you're charging for it, I should say. But then the other part to this is, again, like, what's your budget? What are you planning on investing in? And I think product strategy and like thinking about product management is a skill that you will need to bring on deck in some kind of way. I don't think that person needs to necessarily be like fully full stack developer technical. Do they need to understand it? Yes. Or at least be able to have a conversation with development and engineering? Absolutely. But do they need to be able to code? I don't think that that's necessarily the case always, at least. I think there's certainly scenarios where that would be ideal. But I do think that they need an engineering team, and your GM or president or whoever needs to be able to lead product in some kind of way, because that's going to be a core, like a crucial part of the successful or the success of this spinoff SaaS. If we don't have that, we're not thinking about the business model of software. We're probably thinking about it more like a service. And I think that's kind of where like those two things conflict and it can get confusing.
Mm. Yeah.
But there are others. I can keep going.
Yeah, keep going. What else?
So that's one or two, I guess. We talked about needing a dedicated resource, needing dedicated product strategy, and also engineering. Then there's go-to-market. And when we think about go-to-market, so go-to-market ultimately is, it's all of the pieces that need to be in place in order for you to successfully attract, acquire, convert, and retain these new customers that, again, are not coming to you through your consulting, but through the product on its own. And when it comes to go-to-market, what I find is a lot of the parent brands will have go-to-market somewhat defined for the spinoff SaaS company. But again, they're not thinking about what will it take to sell this to someone who doesn't already know us through our existing parent brand. And again, they're like, these are people who aren't coming to us through our consulting practice. They're coming to us on their own to the software itself. And there are a number of things that I think can go wrong here, but can also go very right. And again, like I said, your mileage may vary. It really does depend on your specific context, your industry, your market, what you've built, how much you're charging, all the things. But I do also think that there are just some best practices here. So you need to determine what your go-to-market motion is going to be. What I mean by that is, and again, if you're not familiar with the SaaS world or the software world, you're going to need to know this terminology. Do you start out more sales-led, meaning people access the product through a demo, and in order for them to experience the value of the product, they either need to sign a contract or an agreement first. They got to talk to a salesperson first. Are you going to be product-led, meaning that they can sign up for the product on their own? They don't have to talk to a salesperson. It's self-service or something to that effect. And they can actually become a customer without ever talking to a salesperson at all. Or do you do a combo? Do you do product-led with sales assist, meaning people can sign up, but maybe certain types of accounts do talk to a salesperson and maybe certain types of accounts don't? Do you do freemium? Do you do free trial? Now we're getting into monetization and like the model here, but those are all of the parts that you really need to understand. Similarly, you got to understand, how do we actually acquire these new customers, again, that are not familiar with our brand through consulting, but through this new SaaS company? And that's where we get into buyer psychology. So how are your prospects currently solving the problem? Even if it's not with other software, but just like, what are they doing instead of using this software? What do you need to message to them or say to them, or how do you need to position in order for you to clearly communicate the value of what it is that you do? And then from there, what is now the conversion experience look like? Like, how does someone who's interested and qualified become a customer? And those are all aspects that it's very tempting to skip. I've talked to brands that are like, they haven't thought about that at all, because again, they're operating under the context of it hasn't dawned on them that they're speaking now to strangers. It's almost like, because they're so used to selling the product through their consulting service, it's hard for them to imagine a world where they're not doing that, even though that's what they want to do. So it's almost like, it's like they don't think about that part. How do you determine the right messaging, and how do you determine the positioning for this product to a stranger who doesn't know you from Adam, as we mentioned before? And also similarly, a bit of the reality check behind that. How well does your product stand on its own two feet outside of your consulting or service that you're selling to people? And I think a lot of, again, brands overestimate how translatable that will be when you don't have the consulting or the service kind of wrapping around a product. So all that to say, those are all things that you've got to validate. And there are a number of ways that we recommend that you do that. Everything from like go-to-market strategy to jobs to be done to audience research. There's a number of ways to really understand this, but it's easy to skip this if you don't understand it or if you don't know that that's what you need to do. What a lot of brands will do, parent brands specifically, the parent brand will often say, let's just hire an agency. And we've done an episode on agencies. So we've actually dug deep into that. And there's all kinds of scenarios where it makes sense to hire an agency early, and there are scenarios where it does not. I will say, in this scenario, if you're a parent brand hoping to spin off a SaaS, I would not immediately hire an agency. I would start with really making sure that you understand your go-to-market strategy. Your GM should be spending almost all of their time here. Like that, and obviously wrapping their arms around product and really understanding like what is it that you've actually built and what is it that you're actually selling. But that early go-to-market strategy needs to really be pretty solidly defined. Even if you don't actually know how it will perform yet, you still want to spend energy and time here, because before you waste a bunch of money trying to figure out what channels will work, you need to figure out, is this product actually a viable solution in the market today as it is on its own two feet without the wrapper of consulting or services? And that's the validation moment that not enough companies spend energy on. And what ends up happening is, your mileage will vary again. There are certainly like people who break the rules here, or like there are certainly success stories here. But what I find happens more often is they get sticker shock, because they discover, well, one, it's extremely expensive to try to hire an agency to help you figure this out by spending a lot of money on like channels and messaging and landing pages and content when you don't even really understand actually like who is your buyer really outside of consulting and services. In the wild, your product has to stand on its own. And you may have hypotheses around who you can sell to, but how does it actually perform even in that context and even in that scenario? They don't validate these assumptions at first, or invalidate them. And it's so expensive to try to use an agency to help you with this, because neither one of you actually knows. And so you're going to have to spend money to figure out, but by doing it almost like with a blindfold on. But I think, and from my experience, I'd rather start more upfront being strategic at first and then determining, okay, based on like a subset of hypotheses, here are now the channels and things that we're going to go and invest in, test, experience, rather than kind of like doing, you know, spaghetti on the wall. Let's try like 50 segments and try like 50 landing pages and a bunch of messaging and a bunch of colors and brand ideas and just see like what happens. Very expensive. And mostly because it takes time even to optimize for like one segment, for one core message or value prop, and for one channel. Like it takes like 3 to 4 months just to get that working well anyway. And you multiply that by 100 and now you're spending bukus of dollars just to kind of figure out like very basic things that you can shortcut actually. And like there is a shortcut here, and it's doing that go-to-market work upfront. But I see a lot of parent brands, they, again, because they're not thinking about this with the context of software. So to them, it makes sense to just hire the agency and just to like go, or maybe not hire the agency, but like build out the marketing team or scale out the sales team without really actually understanding this core part. But again, it's because they're not approaching it like this is a software business, but this is what worked for them in consulting and services. And but it's not always directly applicable. In fact, most times it's not. Sometimes it does work and you get lucky, but it's really luck. It really is that. Like if I were to apply this to the dozens of companies that I've talked to over the past 8 years, it does not work this way. You don't always get lucky, actually.
Yeah. And when you think about the sales process for a services company, it's just so different from the sales process for a SaaS business. So this is a really good, I like these reality checks because, yeah, I think it's easy to fall into that trap when you're in the business of, oh, we have these great customers, we're selling so well, but you're talking to customers in a totally different way. It's consultative, it's just different. And then when you think about a SaaS that's either PLG and you're not talking to them, or it's sales-led, like you still need to get them to talk to you. And they're approaching you with a very different mindset than when they're thinking about hiring you for a service.
And it takes time to figure that part out. I think the other thing too, and this is what I would say for companies that want this to be successful, is you are going to have constraints that are different than like a typical bootstrap founder or VC funded company. And that constraint is it's kind of like corporate venture capital in a way. Not like pure venture capital, but like corporate venture capital, where you are internally funding another company. And chances are you're not going to do that on or with debt. You might do that with profit, actually. And I think that is a constraint, because if your parent company is not as profitable 1 year, then you're not able to invest those profits into the SaaS business. And that could be fluctuating. And then there are other things too, things like, you know, like I don't want to scare anyone off from doing this, but this just takes longer than what people budget for or expect. I think they think, you know, oh, this will be profitable in like a year. There are certainly cases where that happens. Like I said, if you're charging like $50,000 for like a deal or what have you, yeah, you'll with those types of ACVs, you'll certainly see profit like pretty fast, I think. But if you're not charging like enterprise rates or anything like that, this is going to be slower than what you think it'll be. And also, it might not scale as quickly as you think it will. We just had a call with someone where, you know, they've got about 7 or 8 clients now, customers on their SaaS product. But for next year, the goal, like they don't know what the goal is, because in their minds, they're like, well, it could be 100 or it could be more. Like, and I think realistically speaking, that has to be backed into, right? Like that's like you have to determine like what part of the market actually can buy this product. So there's total addressable market, TAM, and most founders calculate that whenever they go out and they get funding from VCs. But then there's TAM, SAM, and SOM. So there's serviceable addressable market and then serviceable operable market. SAM and SOM are a part of your TAM, and those are people who can actually use the product like as it is right now based on their context. And you'll find it's a much smaller percentage. So realistically speaking, while there may be tons of opportunity, the reality is only about like 5 to 10% of your market at any given time is actually going to be looking for a solution. If you have a very large market, that's a very big number. But if your market is relatively defined, that's a smaller number. And like I said, like there's so many more like other directions I could go in, but those I think are some of the big reasons. And there, like I said, there are others. Like it takes longer than what you think. It's going to require more budget than you think. I think a lot of companies under budget, whatever number you have, double it, quite literally. If you're like, oh, it'll take about $1 million, budget for three or two. Like it's two to three times what you think it'll be. It just is. And it's because unless you have a experienced leader and team here, you're gonna waste a lot of time and money and effort because you don't know what you don't know. You're operating, you're applying your consulting and services brain to a SaaS and software product. And I find that does not work the way that you think that it will, especially if you're trying to do PLG. Maybe if you're doing enterprise software, it certainly can apply. I think like there are definitely some really nice overlaps, I think, with like if you're used to running consulting and you're used to selling like high ticket consulting projects, selling a high ticket software to enterprise is going to feel probably very similar, actually. But if you're doing product led growth, self service, or even like product led with sales assist, it's going to feel like a different animal. If you're doing marketplaces, completely different beast, like just completely different. And I think unless you just have like a rockstar experienced team, you're going to waste a lot of time, money, and energy. And unless you have a trusted consulting partner like Demand Maven, just say like shameless plug here, but like unless you have a trusted advisor or partner here, it's just so easy to literally set money on fire in the front yard. Like it's just easy to burn cash and kind of create a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, I think unless you have really good executive internal support from the parent company, you know, a lot of the times, like the conversation is usually like they're dipping their toe into this. They're not fully committed. They're not like, yep, we're committing 3 to 5 million for the next 3 to 5 years. It's usually not like that. It's usually more like, oh, we're going to give you like 200K and like see what you do with it. And you kind of create a self-fulfilling prophecy in that way, I think, sometimes, because if you don't know what you don't know, then like that money is going to go to waste so quickly. And now you have to go back to your leaders and be like, actually, like we need a little more. We need something different. And you've only got so many times of doing that before the CEO is like, you're cut off. I'm sorry. Like, I don't know what to tell. We know what to tell you. I've seen that happen several times too. And, you know, like those are obviously scenarios that we try to help companies avoid, but it's one of those things where it's like, I'm recording this because this is what I see so often in these specific contexts and scenarios that I would love for people to avoid these scenarios, just from what I've learned. But yeah, like it's easier said than done, but there are ways to avoid these pitfalls. And a lot of that, you know, the big ones I feel like we've talked through, but yeah, hopefully this is helpful to folks.
I think the only thing I was thinking of after what you just said was when you said like, okay, so they give someone in the business like 200K, like parent company gets 200K to kind of go off the side and do it. Like in my head, it's like at that point, you might as well be a technical founder that's starting their own thing. Right. People that we've worked with that are, if not, then it's really needs to be a thought out investment that you're thinking about upfront. You're hiring a dedicated resource. You're doubling the budget in your mind because it's going to get bigger. It's its own venture.
I would argue that you really can't toe dip in this. Like you either, this is such a crude saying, but you kind of need to like shit or get off the pot, in my opinion. Like you commit to this. Now, I will say, like, and I'm sure that there are probably folks that are out there listening who might be like, I've actually seen this be successful where maybe like a services or consulting firm or what have you, like they do spin off a SaaS and it is like an incremental investment. But what my assumption is there is I would actually argue that that still is a commitment. Like you are seeing positive signs of life, which means that you are now still going to be committed to it. They probably got lucky though, is my take. That might have been a luck scenario, or someone maybe had that experience and they were able to translate it to SaaS or what have you.
Right. And it's still a cost for the resources that are also running the other business.
You know what's interesting? I just thought about Moz is actually kind of like this. Rand Fishkin ran I'm pretty sure he ran an SEO agency first. And then he built Moz. But I would argue, though, that he committed to Moz. Like, it wasn't a, we're going to dip our toe in and kind of see.
And Search Pilot.
Search Pilot was like this too. Yeah, yeah.
But same.
But what made Search Pilot and also Moz successful was a dedicated leader. It's not just like a, we're going to see kind of what happens. Although I feel like Rand might actually argue that that did kind of happen. But I think like, I think in a way it was the right time. It was the right market and it was the right context. But eventually they did commit fully to the software. And I'm actually, I'll have to go back and double check if Rand actually let the services agency go or if like what happened there. But I'm almost positive it started that way. And yeah, Distilled spun off Search Pilot, another successful use case in my opinion. But Will Critchlow is a dedicated resource. Like he was the CEO. He's the GM essentially. Now more formally CEO. But Search Pilot was its own thing and it was a commitment. And I think like if you're a large parent brand and you want to like dip your toe into something, I don't think it always works that way. Now I will say, and this is actually another example, kind of going back to my development firm example, I don't think it was a stretch for SEO, imagine an SEO, both of these actually were SEO agencies, but it's not a stretch to me for an SEO agency to offer software in the same way mm-hmm. that it's a stretch for me for a PR firm to offer software, where mm-hmm. in SEO technology, certainly, at least back in the day, it was around tech in the way that it was around like websites and Google in search performance. It's not a stretch to me to offer software in that context as it is you're in construction and now you're offering software. That to me does feel more of like a, not that it's a disconnect or even that it can't work or doesn't work, but it does feel more like a, you're going to have to put in more energy and effort to make that work. And it's going to be less of a toe dipping in situation than it is going to be like a, you might have to commit. And if you commit, give it a big swing commit and not a small swing commit, because it just requires so much more than what you think. But now that is a really good point. Now I'm curious. I'm curious to go back into Rand's history in particular, because I do feel like there was a moment where he was like, okay, we're not doing the SEO agency anymore. We're just focusing on Moz. And I think that is a necessary commitment level that you do have to have if you're serious about making the SaaS part work. But if you're not, then you do, I think, create a self-fulfilling prophecy. It will fail because there is no one dedicated to it. But I'm so silly. I almost completely forgot about those as examples. And those are really good examples. Search Pilot and Moz to me are both very successful.
Yeah.
I think they're successful examples. But yeah. Okay. Now I'm curious, like, if there's anything we've left.
I know. We've left behind. People have to tell us.
Yeah. I will say, yeah, I do think part of the secret sauce is also hiring experienced contributors. And I think for like a Moz and for a Search Pilot, so Search Pilot obviously came much later, but I think for Moz, you know, Moz was in the early days of SaaS and software. So I don't think we didn't have the same playbooks or understanding of how SaaS and software worked back then, I think, in the same way that we do now. Like now we have a much clearer understanding of like what software and SaaS maturity looks like. So I do think that today, by today's standards, it does look different than maybe what it did mm-hmm. 10 or 15 years ago. But yeah, I definitely think like there has to be a certain level of commitment and like true testing of investment. The last thing I will say. So on the topic of hiring experienced members or contributors, so I just had a conversation with a founder, and this was not like in the context of like spinning out like a SaaS or anything. This was like an actual software founder. He had this hypothesis of like, yeah, you know, I'm kind of thinking I just hire someone like fresh out of college, like to run marketing. And I was like, don't do that. That is not a great idea. Like, sure, you would save money, but would you? Like long term, there is a trade-off here and you will waste 1 to 2 years. And also put that person under like unnecessary pressure to learn and figure out what even it is that they're doing. It's been a minute since I've been in a marketing classroom, but from what I remember about marketing classes in college are that they are not teaching you practical applications of growing a business. It's far more fundamental, extremely high level. Like I think you learn like the four P's, and I I think I've heard about the four P's like once ever in my software career. Like nobody thinks about the four P's, even though that is technically what we're doing, but no one's like thinking about like, oh, I'm going to help you figure out your four P's. It's no, like,
right. Or writing a business plan.
And they're not teaching like practical marketing application in the way, in the same way that you would learn from like Pavilion or Reforge or Grow Class or like any of these like more niche educational, like they're actually focused on teaching you marketing for SaaS in a practical way. And there are a million classes and courses you can find about like how to do SEO or how to do ads or how to do whatever. But they're not teaching that shit in universities. So like, don't hire the fresh grad. No Tino shade to the fresh grads out there. I'm sure y'all are awesome. But like, I promise you, you don't want that smoke. Because what's going to happen is you're going to hire that person and be like, you're a marketer. And then they're going to be like, okay, so you're going to help us like triple our MRR, right? And that marketer is not going to know like left or right if that is even realistic. And that to me is the pitfall of hiring someone who does not have that experience. So whatever you do, don't do that. Or if you do that, set clear expectations for what that is going to be, not only for that person, but for yourself. But don't hire the fresh grad expecting them to be your CMO. That's just not going to happen. I don't care what y'all say. Of course, there are going to be bright, shining examples of people who break the rules, but that's not 99% of what actually happens. So don't do that. Hire more experienced contributors if that is what you need and care about and want and have the budget for. But anyway, I digress. Cool. Anything else before we jump? Well,
no, I mean, I think if people want to do a spinoff or an internal SaaS, then book a call with, listen to this, but book a call with Asia.
Listen to this episode.
And Demand Maven, because it's worth talking through with someone with experience and that has a SaaS mindset.
I will say, like, whether you hire a provider like us or not, like, I'm an open book, like, I will give it to you straight. And I've heard feedback in the past that that is extremely valuable, and I've saved a lot of people a lot of heartache, I think. But yeah, like, I'm more than happy to chat through your exact scenario and like your context and give you my thoughts and also paint the picture for what that might look like and how, like, what your risks are here and how you can potentially avoid them entirely. Not everything is obviously going to be avoidable, but I also hope that somehow that this reaches CEOs of these firms as well, who are thinking about investing and doing in this and understanding that if you're actually going to do this, like, do it right if you can. Because I will say, running a SaaS business is so fun. And I obviously am super passionate about it and I love it. But it's really hard to do halfway. And even if you were to do it halfway, it still requires a considerable amount of investment, probably way more than what you're anticipating. And also much harder than what you might think. But yeah, I want to make, hopefully that is clear too for CEOs who are thinking about this. And if you are thinking about this, hopefully this serves as a resource for how to avoid like what makes this fail, because I've seen that a million times. And I would love to help businesses avoid that entirely if they can, and just build better businesses in general. But anyway, I digress. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. And thank you, Kim, for talking me through that, asking me questions as per usual.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like hopefully this will be a good resource for folks.
Yeah. Thanks, Asia. This was fun.